You're about to listen to a Second City Works presentation, brought to you in partnership with WGN Radio. Subscribe on your favorite podcast streaming platform or listen on WGNradio.com. And be sure to share.
The Second City is a world-famous comedy theater, and it got so famous because it has produced generation after generation of comedy superstars. That didn't happen by magic. Second City's improvisational pedagogy fuels great performance, and the same practices that have made stars of everyone from Bill Murray to Tina Fey can be applied for success offstage, at work, at home, and in the world. I'm Kelly Leonard, Vice President of Creative Strategy, Innovation, and Business Development at the Second City. This podcast is about collaborative conversations, discovering connections, and building a better future. This is Getting the Yes And.
I'm talking to Matt Bean, who does field research on work involving robots and AI. He has published in top management journals such as Administrative Science Quarterly and Harvard Business Review and spoken on the TED stage. He is an assistant professor in the Technology Management Department at the University of California, Santa Barbara, and a digital fellow with Stanford's Digital Economy Lab and MIT's Institute for Digital Economy. He got his PhD from MIT Sloan School of Management. So he's got a new book. It's called Skill Code, How to Stave Human Ability in an Age of Intelligent Machines. I was blown away by this book. It is going to probably be a very different conversation than maybe you think when we talk about AI. Also, gift for our listeners. Matt was kind enough to set up a link that you can go to get the first chapter of this book for free. So if you go to gettingtoyesand.theskillcodebook.com, so that's gettingtoyesand.theskillcodebook.com. You will get the first chapter for free. Enjoy the pod.
Days can't be counted by the money spent. Today was just another better left unsaid. Days can't be counted by the time to rent. Tomorrow's just another like the one that comes next. The corner of the highway that leads to the job, at the desk by the boss with the elegant watch. The tick of the clock and the tick of the clock mark the moments till the ticking stops.
Matt Bean, welcome to the show.
I'm delighted to be here. Really been looking forward to it.
When I talk to people about how Second City has been able to churn out generation after generation of comedy superstars, and we're talking 65 years, I often describe this place as akin to a teaching hospital. So we have a school and a professional theater, and students work with experts in comedy and improvisation. But even when you get to the professional stage, you have a director and you have producers, and there's ongoing mentorship and there's workshops, and Stephen Colbert will drop in, and there's salons and things like that. And it sounds, when you're talking about your understanding of the way we become really good at something, the way we learn something but then turn into masters of the work we do, that's kind of the process. So that's a good process to have, is this idea of novices and mentorship and the unrelenting failure that has you keep practicing and practicing and practicing.
Yeah, and it's not a nice thing to have. It's strictly necessary, according to science. So what you have there, and what I saw in the operating room, and I've seen in a few other places, it's a particularly concentrated, familiar instantiation of that somebody in a marble sculptor's workshop in ancient Greece would also recognize. Humans have been organizing themselves this way to get cool stuff done across levels of expertise. The archaeological record goes back 160,000 years. So it's as old as it's prehistory, right?
Yeah.
And it's just that in modern workplaces, there are many other ways in which it shows up informally that don't kind of all show up in a room in where you can see all the moving parts in one spot. So I could have just as well done my research at Second City or in an operating theater. There's a few places left where it kind of looks, it's easy to all see for one person. Just sit in a room, see the whole machine working. Most workplaces aren't like that anymore.
Right. But I imagine, I always talk about this because I recall my first job for like a company, and that was the Jewel grocery store here in the Chicagoland area. Yep. And that was the place where I was a bagger, and then I checked out grocery. It seemed like chaos, and it was fairly controlled chaos, of course. But the way
I got good at my gig was all the same things that happen at Second City and happen in hospitals.
Exactly right. And so this is why I said it's strictly necessary, because I said just now, most workplaces don't kind of look like that. That is zero. That's not evidence that it's not happening. It's just that if you were casually looking for it, it's not going to smack you upside the head like a 2x4. You go to a grocery store. In fact, go to a digital workplace where everyone's on Zoom and no one's ever met in person. Still happening. It's absolutely the sort of taken for granted infrastructure for how we go from knowing about something, learning, you know, book knowledge, class kind of learning, to being able to do it reliably under pressure. That's skill.
Okay. So this presents a problem in the world that we live in right now. And you write in the book, quote, "In millions of workplaces, we're blocking the ability to master new skills because we are separating junior workers from senior workers, novices from experts by inserting technology between them." Talk more.
Yeah. So then I saw this in stark form in the operating room across five of the top teaching hospitals in the U.S. at the beginning of my dissertation. So this is it's over a decade now ago, dear God. I expected things to be different. So I had gotten a breeze sort of whistle stop tour of the operating room and seen this new surgical robot. And I mean, it's 2,000 pounds of equipment and you control it with your hands and your feet. The joke on the street was you're an organist. Ha ha. And I had also seen on TV a traditional, you know, surgical procedures that involve two people and four hands. And so I thought, okay, how you learn how to do this has got to be pretty darn different. And so then I got approval to do the study and spent of being in the operating room, typing as furiously as I could on a surgical stand in my scrubs. And I realized, boy, this sucks. Like these residents are really struggling to learn. And this will tell you how, I don't know, hard the work is, I could say, or how stupid I am, some combination of the two. It took me about a year to name why. And then maybe another 2 to 3 years to really name that more crisply, because I had to look at other contexts to see this thing abstracted from surgery. But the basic answer is novice optional. The robot itself allowed that surgeon to do all of the work by themselves, beginning to end, aside from docking the robot to the patient, which is a euphemism for inserting force instruments through keyhole incisions into the patient's abdomen or something, and then undocking it. The surgeon can control four arms and they can pause as they're doing it. And that means if you're the novice and I'm the senior surgeon, you're now optional, strictly speaking. Like, I don't need you. And there's a patient on the table and I know for a fact you're going to be slower and make more mistakes. So how much are you going to get to operate? Within 2 weeks, I saw that the answer was you'd show up, walk in the room, help me set the thing up, and then you would sit there and watch for 4 hours. Maybe you'd get lucky and I'd give you 10 minutes of practice. Whereas the old school method, and by the way, it's still happening, I need you physically to do the work. You're in the pool for 4.5 hours swimming. Yep. You might be in the shallow end. We have lots of degrees of freedom. And by the way, I don't have to tell you you're screwing up publicly on TV, which in robot surgery, everyone can see what you're doing. And I'm going to have to yell at you to be heard. So anyway, it's a very intense version of the problem. But now we're seeing it everywhere with things like ChatGPT. Bottom line, one expert can pick up a technology and do more, better, faster by themselves, which the expert loves, the organization that's investing in that loves. And who doesn't love it is the person who has no power of voice, which is the novice. And they are struggling to get a chance to even stand up to bat.
There's so many things to talk about here. First, no one is talking about this.
Right, because nobody owns that problem. Who owns it, really?
Oh.
Like, who is responsible if 3 to 5 years from now, the talent bench just can't play ball.
HR, and we don't listen to HR?
Well, HR are second class citizens. In fact, often have in many organizations, not all. I'm now talking to HR, talent development, learning and development, people ops, whatever you want to call it. In certain organizations where that function is viewed as a critical strategic asset.
That's,
then they are part of a conversation where it's like, you know, the fabric of how we adapt to change in this organization is getting nuked by the way that we are buying and putting technology to use. And so those are that crowd has resonated, but many of those folks, and no knock on them, I came out of that crowd in a certain sense. They've been trained to train in ways that are more about compliance and box checking and formal training that everybody can. And what we're talking about is not formal training. It's not classes. It's not written down. It's like learning by osmosis, by working with somebody who knows more. We don't even have names for that in English because we all take it for granted. So
yeah.
That's the trouble, is that there's nobody who's, you know, on the hook for noticing even, or has the professional vocabulary to notice it, the mental Velcro, and then the authority to say, hang on, whoa. Let's get our productivity and keep the skills sharp. Can we do both, kids? Anyway.
Yeah. So the other thing I think about this is, you know, when we go into organizations, I think people think they're going to be role-playing or scrimmaging. And certainly that has a place. But what we're normally doing is saying the skills we're teaching the Stephen Colbert's, the Tina Fey's of the world, are like, in one sense, this is a listening exercise. It's just to make you a better listener. And I think when you have in these surgical settings, when you have the novices working with the experts, is they're not doing the whole thing. They are practicing, you know, this one move. And that's like, get good at that move, get good at the other move, get good at this move. Then you put it together. And we don't, there's not many places, you know, sort of educational systems that seem to speak that language, except for the arts.
Yeah.
Which, if you look at symphonies and dance companies, they're totally doing that. And sports.
Yep. And you'll notice that in all of those areas, the ratio of offline practice to online performance is inverted from most professions. Surgery is the opposite. Surgery, you get maybe 1/500th the amount of time in the sort of offline practice and rehearsal mode, compared to you are supposed to learn by walking in the OR and just beginning operations on a live patient. Now, are you at the edge of the danger zone? Of course you are in the beginning. You know, you're going to be involved in a sort of a more, they call it in surgery, see one, do one, teach one. So you want to progress from mostly watch, a little like flick the lights on and off, please, kind of action, scuff work, all the way towards, by the end of that process, 5 years later, someone's looking over your shoulder. They're in your position, right? And there's research in surgery where they call, this is the main assumed way you should learn how to do surgery. They call it dwell time. In papers. The assumption is if you're in the OR, you are building neuronal connections and reliable capability that a patient can count on. And it's just not a social fact anymore. Like if you set foot in a robotic OR, most residents are watching TV. So the main thing to say about how organizations run, how the world runs, is we all take that informal process so much for granted that the investment in organizations, if you watch where the dollars are being spent to invest in building capability and so on, Second City is an extraordinarily rare exception where everyone gets that. You can drop your books at the door, kid. Show up over there and you're going to do this activity first until you can do it. And it's not about whether, you know, you pass some abstract test. It's like, did that person laugh? Was your timing good? No, if not, please do try again. And you may leave if you choose not to progress. That's up to you. Anyway, we don't invest in that. We don't have names for it. We don't build social machinery inside organizations. It's like what the world spends about $500 million on training a year.
Yeah.
And I've done as best I can to figure out what percentage of that is invested in this informal social process we're talking about. 1/1000th of a percent is about, right? And it's just because it's 160,000 years old.
Yeah. All right. I promise not to dwell completely on Second City, but this also came up in the book, and I thought it was really interesting. So we got sold a few years back, a couple years back, and I helped lead the sale from Second City's end. And we were down to the final two bidders. And it was over a weekend, and ownership was deciding who to go with. And my wife, Anne, was roommates with Stephen Colbert in college, and he was in my first cast, so we're old friends. And he texts us, and he's like, hey, can you FaceTime really quick? And we're like, sure. And it turns out he had been consulting one of the potential buyers without telling anyone. He was doing it privately. And he was saying to us, what I want you guys to know, and please tell this to the current owners who are about to sell, is, you know, I will be involved. I will help. And he is, of course, the head of our board now, artistic board. He's on our board. But this is what he said. He goes, I want to make sure that the things that are broken at Second City that need to stay broken, stay broken.
Ah, brilliant.
Right? So I know that's brilliant. Why do you think that's brilliant?
Well, so it's got to be pretty rough for it to work for learning. To really build chops in a small amount of time, and this I go into in the book, that is the skill code, right? The first, there's three C's in that skill code. The first is challenge. The world has become a padded playground in certain senses. And it is, the research is just super clear on this, and I found this in every study I've done. You have to be profoundly uncomfortable performing not at your best and utterly focused in, you know, in surgeons' cases, like literally sweating in the console to be learning. And you are not satisfied. You are not relaxed. You are not having fun in the capital F sense of the word. It's more like F-U is the in the fun. And that's how you know you're learning. Now, there's a Goldilocks thing with that. Of course, you can have too much. And it needs, and you can get further faster if you've got somebody who's sort of scaffolding you through that challenge, right? So you're not doing it alone. If everything is too straightforward, written by the book, by a manual, easy, then you're depriving people of the challenge that they need to learn and grow. And that's just one of the dimensions. So, and that's the one that, you know, if you talk to an educator, somebody who's been trained about what human beings need to learn and build skill, challenge, they won't use that term. They'll use desirable difficulty. There's a bunch of different literatures on that. So anyway, waste, inefficiency, slowdown, things not being readily available on the how do I manage myself around here kind of thing. That also helps with the second C in the skill code, which is complexity. So when we make it, ChatGPT is a great example of this. When you pick up that new tool, you can just write your memo in 1/100th the time that it used to take you. And that's good for your short run, immediate focal productivity. But what you lose is this sort of, I'm going to put big air quotes around this wasteful tour of adjacent work, comparable problems, other people's interactions with you that give you a broader sense of what's going on that you're embedded in so that you can react better to surprise, novelty, handle complexity. You need to be digesting the broader world and going broad just as you're going deep. And part of what enforces that is inefficiency. Like it's a mess around here. And if it is a mess, you have to contend with that. And that means you don't just end up with, you know, getting good at saying yes and when somebody throws you a flaming ball of turd. Also understand how this business runs, if that's your cup of tea. Or, what about this technology, like this camera? Like, I'm going to learn a little bit about that. Or what about, you know, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. Different people go different ways or different techniques within their discipline. Part of that complexity associated with work, if it's too straightforward, you skip right past it. You don't get this broader career enhancing journey. And the last part is about connection. So and that's the third C in the skill code. That's bonds of trust and respect between human beings. And part of where that comes from, there are great studies on this, is if you are suffering together in a difficult effort and everyone's sort of vulnerable, you are going to start to build bonds of trust and respect with each other as you do so. And if processes are very well oiled, very straightforward, A, you have less collateral contact with folks. But B, you need each other less. because it's you're in a well-oiled machine. So I took a giant leap and assumed part of the value of Second City is that it's a chaos conundrum. It's like there's useful structure, but it also blows up in your face. Nobody quite knows what's going on. Everybody kind of knows that. Anyway, and that's part of what it's real kind of. It's more obvious that those would be assets in a domain where getting nudged out of your comfort zone, seeing new possibilities and reacting in a creative way is the coin of the realm. So
yeah.
In other places like the Navy, it's not at all obvious that you want things to be quite so chaotic if you have a nuclear engine driving a, you know, many millions of ton vehicle across the ocean and so on. But even there, it's interesting. There are studies that show that if things are too smooth, too easy, people will not learn.
So what's funny about this is that, in fact, the most rigorous sort of studies around improvisation are done in military settings and hostage negotiations and disaster relief, all those places, because indeed you're navigating complexity, you're having to pivot, you're having to take whatever information. Sometimes there are no scripts with these things. Carl Weick's work that he did on aircraft carrier ships the ability to communicate in this split second that you need to do. So it's like, no, those people get it. It's just that, like, I don't know that Google or IBM do.
Right.
And I'm sure there are people there. Well, there are people there because IBM trains with us, but and Google does too. But not totally. So let me ask this question, which I know is on the mind of all of the listeners of the podcast: are robots coming for our jobs?
Sure. Yes.
Okay.
Yep. And guess what? That's the wrong question.
Okay.
So, you can assume that with any new technology that is automate some form of work that offers even a marginal improvement on what we used to be able to do, what's going to happen is organizations are going to mess around, waste a lot of effort, time, and so on, but they're going to try to put it to work just to make themselves more efficient. In our economy anyway, it's cheaper to invest in capital than labor. And so you're going to have that swap happening. And as a result, even when it's not a general purpose technology like the steam engine or large language models like we're dealing with now, people are going to lose their jobs. The stats on that are just very clear. However, you're talking the tune of, say, as long as it's not a giant general purpose technology, you're talking, you know, in a given year, say 10,000 in the US. Now, for each one of those 10,000 people, robots I've been studying, obviously, for years now. There are great studies on this. So you implement robots in a given catchment area, and you know, some small number of people for that catchment area, say 3 to 5 for a zip code, will lose a job. And for the overall U.S. economy, that sums up to, say, 10K a year. Very serious, not cool event for those people. And usually those are the people who can least afford to lose that job. And that is not fair. And it's a waste of resources to handle it that way. However, what's going on now for, let's just say, 2.7 billion adults in the world right now is that not they're going to lose their job, but they're going to have to change how they do their job. And they had to change it starting about a year ago, given the advent of ChatGPT. In fact, the stats show that they are. Change costs money and time too, causes harm, is difficult because you have to learn new skills to handle the new way to do your job that involves this thing, right? So the best models out there, and they're very conservative, suggest that 80% of working adults, that's that 2.6 or 2.7 billion figure I mentioned, are going to have to change between 10 and 15% of how they do their job these days because of ChatGPT. How are they going to learn those skills? Who's going to teach them? We're all just taking for granted that they're going to learn through that process that we were talking about earlier. And we're nuking it right now at the worst possible time. That is a $1 trillion problem. That reskilling problem is the term that people often use. I'm fine with that. That's the one we should be talking about, because tens of thousands of people losing jobs every year, that might, I don't know, but it could. There's a world I can imagine where that's actually too small a number. Like, we need more change in the economy, and not everybody wins all the time. But for us to be healthy collectively, we need to be eliminating jobs and adding new ones. But it is that's just rounding error compared to 2.6 billion adults needing to make 15% change yesterday with no support.
So that's a big deal. But this is not a pessimistic book. You are not pessimistic. It doesn't seem. You point out the problems. Yep. Why are you not pessimistic, given I imagine we live in the same world?
Yeah.
we hear right. The same things.
Well, so I think a fair part of that answer is that I am not a pessimist, right? Yeah, I mean, I was born a guy who looks and sees, you know, like the world is a beautiful place that is receptive to our creative efforts, and it's a difficult place, but possibilities abound, etc. So I think I have to be honest about that. At the same time, I think there's a sort of more objective and empirical, like research based answer to that, which is that every study I have done, every single time, I've designed to look for positive needles in the negative haystack of new technologies. Yeah. So, and I found it every single time. So in the case of surgery, I'll just give you a quick example. I noticed within a couple of weeks, boy, oh boy, does robotic surgical skills development suck. Most people are struggling. And I announced that fact to my dissertation committee, and they're like, oh, that's kind of not surprising. Like, that's not a scientific discovery. And I said, but I did find three people across these five hospitals who, in spite of this ridiculous barrier to participation, are shockingly good, really fast. And they seem to be doing the same things independent of one another to get their skill. And my committee said, that's interesting. Can you go find 40 to 80 more people like that? And so that was the next 2 years of my life, or a year and a half, getting attached to 18 more of the top, say, 30 teaching hospitals in the States, and designing a study where I could scientifically go find matched pairs of surgeons in training at each hospital. And I was blinded to whether or not they were the ace pupil locally or not. And then I would end up talking with them and interviewing them exactly the same way. And it, lo and behold, it did turn out that that all of the, you know, at each institution, there was usually one who was doing the same three set of things to build their skill and get ahead. So I'm always on the hunt. If you look at the literature on new tech and how the world changes in response to it, basically the story is we get a new tech. Everyone assumes that the world is going to change and we're going to redo things. And it takes between a decade and four decades to figure out the healthy new way of doing things with that thing. What that obscures is that, in fact, it's a provable thing. Somebody had figured it out way sooner. They just didn't get airtime. The word didn't get out. Their success was partial. Humans are amazingly creative. And I can guarantee you in year one with ChatGPT, somebody has figured out the way of handling that both improves productivity and enhances their skill. For instance, the opposite is what you should expect. And we just don't know who they are. We don't know where they are.
Yeah.
They don't have to share. And so my job with all my studies is to find those people sooner so that we can learn from them more aggressively and figure out. And that's what this book is, by the way. It's my best report across more than 30 occupations and kind of work conditions. Like, what is it that these early deviants who are protecting their skill are finding in their work so that they can, and protecting new conditions they're creating so that they can build their skill? That's the job of the book. That's the job of all my research. So I'm optimistic because I design my studies to make me find early deviant success. And that's where, you know, that's what I'm looking at all the time. So I know for certain, if we can manage to learn from those folks, we're going to be able to avoid a whole bunch of potholes down the road.
Yeah. So these deviant learners, the shadow learning that you talk about, I was thinking about this and thinking about in the past, do I have any models for this that I can sort of come up with? And I started thinking about, like, you know, Jimi Hendrix, because he's left-handed playing the guitar upside down. I started thinking about the Beatles going to Hamburg and having to do what they did in terms of, like, this, like, not a comfortable situation. And they came back with a different level of skill set. And that maybe maybe that's a model that has always existed in terms of, yeah. Okay. So that's kind of what you think too?
And just to cue in listeners, the core finding of that first robotic surgical study was that there's this subgroup of folks who managed to build their skill, but they did it through deviance. And I called them shadow learners. And by deviance, I don't mean like, oh, just doing something nobody had ever thought of. I mean doing stuff that everyone would look at and say, that is not appropriate. Like operating on a patient without the senior surgeon in the room, to put a fine point on it. No, that's not against the law, as far as I know. But no one would agree that that's ideal. And I've got a bunch of other examples in the book. So the short answer there is it is particularly pronounced when you have a big change that changes the way that one goes about learning, the approved way, so to speak. Mm-hmm. If that no longer works, there's research from the 40s in sociology that says basically if you have a goal that people value and the approved way of getting to that goal won't work, then a small subset of people will bend and break rules to get to that goal. Crime is a good example, actually. How about earning money for many people, right? So the evidence for that is just like a mountain of evidence. And this is just that effect for skill. And I am very confident. I have data going back, say, to this great first primary data going back to, say, the 40s in the US, that kind of behavior is available. You can see it if you're looking for it, when there isn't giant technological change. It's just, it's harder than it should be to get the skill you need. People bend and break rules to get it. I think that's probably as old as the pyramids, probably older. It's just when we have new intelligent technologies showing up on our doorstep, ChatGPT is a great example. It is easier to hide what you're doing with it. And organizations are banning it everywhere. And by the way, it helps me be 2.5 to 4 times more productive. What's going to happen? Some folks are going to figure out how to use it anyway on their phone, and they're going to be learning new tactics and techniques for learning itself that we need to learn from, but they have total plausible deniability. They can absolutely just say, oh, yeah, no, I'm just been practicing, right?
I think of various steps in my life where I've been exposed to Viktor Frankl, you know, in his work and being like, oh my God, this is really speaking to me. And one of the studies when we were working with Heather Caruso when she was at the University of Chicago was her exposing us to this idea of self-determination theory.
Yes.
And you talk about that and you highlight in the book. And I think it's worth going into, because I don't know that we have recently in the pod, is what is it and why is it so important? Because it's the cornerstone of a lot of work that I know I've been involved with and other academics have been involved with.
Yeah. So so that was the great privilege of getting to write this book, by the way. So like, I'm not a psychologist. That's a psychological theory. I'm more a sociologist and technologist. But to write this book and have it be authoritative, I had to go over all known research from all fields, like psychology is a proximate one. Try kinesiology, sports medicine. Yeah. There's a wide variety of research that talks about what it is that drives us to learn and how we learn and how we build skill. Self-determination theory, I listed it in a book somewhere. The original papers there have over 2 million citations in academia. Mm. That is absolutely unheard of, like in social science. That just doesn't happen. And that's because DC and Ryan basically did some incredibly incisive early studies that showed that there's this holy trinity of sources of motivation for human beings that are just evident across cultures, time, space, modes of communication, ways of organizing, one of which is, and this is the name for self-determination theory, is autonomy. You need to feel that the choices in your life are your own and make sense to you given your context. That seems obvious to say, well, but that's that was not obvious before, that's a sort of core driver. The one that I really pull on in the book, the second one's competence, by the way.
Yep.
And competence and skill are kissing cousins. And then the third one is, given different terms, but bottom line, it's relationships, human relationships. And that's in the third C of that the three C's in the skill code is human connection, bonds of trust and respect. The bedrock underneath that is largely self-determination theory, that human beings value bonds of trust and respect between human beings intrinsically. It's something that you don't need an additional incentive to pursue. We all just our lives are better uniformly, universally, the world around, to the extent to which we have healthy bonds of trust and respect in our life. Now, there's a bunch of studies, especially around self-determination theory, that sort of showed effects of that in education, because education was kind of ground zero for those folks. But that's since been studied in many other contexts.
Yeah, I remember Heather and I talking about this one day in a DEI context, and I sort of had my mind blown. I was literally sitting in a hospital. My daughter was ill, and we're talking over the phone, and she was talking about the fact that, especially in a DEI setting, people don't feel competent.
Yep.
And a thing came over me where I'm like, oh, that's very different from them being bad human beings. I was like, because I think that's where we go to. Well, yes. You must be doing this very bad when you're like, oh, they feel. And I know this because, like, again, I'm a 57-year-old man who lives in a world now with technology that I can barely understand, and I get scared of. And then I realize, okay, like I just don't feel competent. That's my problem. And so when I cannot worry about that, yes, then I can go into these. I can figure it out. And I usually can figure it out.
Right.
Because I have autonomy and I have connection. But it's those three, when those three things are not working, and, you know, again, it's very Taoist in that sense of, it's like, it's not one or the other. It is all of them working in a mix. And that is profoundly, I think, and again, this goes to the, you're not a pessimist, and I'm not a pessimist, because when you understand ideas like that, you're like, that's why this is hard.
Right. And in fact, if you go, like, I mean, I'm lucky enough to have it be my professional responsibility to go actually study how do people manage to preserve those three things when the environment is otherwise really hostile to them?
That's right.
And so I recently published a study, and this addresses your sort of 57-year-old man, new technology, I don't feel competent question. A study on what we called, Callan Anthony is a co-author of mine on the piece. She's at NYU. On inverted apprenticeship, which basically we compared her investment banking data. She spent a couple years in an investment bank, much as I spent it in the OR. And we looked at, like, how is it that senior experts manage to learn new tech? Why is that a question or a puzzle? Because A, they're booked dealing with complicated problems. They're really busy. Two, they're supposed to look like experts.
That's right.
Their status, and in fact, their people's willingness to trust them with problems is contingent on their seeming like they know what they're doing. And so anyway, there's a big problem for them because they don't have the clock time, and there's a status risk. And so what we found is there's different ways that are more and less effective to do it, but they would find junior people, novices coming up who are supposed to be learning, do have discretionary time, and partner with them to jointly explore the new tech. There are ways of doing that that were very extractive and toxic for the junior person. Let me be very clear. But there were some that where a rising tide lifted all boats. Everyone, the junior person learned about their profession, their occupation, how to do the work, but also helped that senior person get up to speed on the new technology, and not just awareness, like building skill. It was time efficient, status enhancing for both people. So it's deviant, actually. You're not supposed to be doing what I just described in some context, but leaders did it anyway experts did it anyway, because they need to stay sharp. They need to be able to solve the next problem.
Yeah. I mean, in my context, I literally ask the younger coworkers here for help, like if I've got an Excel problem or whatever. And part of why I feel two things okay with that. One is the studies I've read around leaders asking questions and asking for advice of people who are maybe in a lower status than them in an organization, how that can be very pro-social, but also offering up my own time to mentor with my knowledge and my time of being here. And that seems to work out for everyone. No one seems to have a problem with that.
Right.
That requires curiosity and humility.
Yes, and setting up time and space, you know, like if you to allow for it. In other words, making a few sacrifices, right?
I mean, yeah,
it's not a free lunch. If you want the gory detail, in some cases, literal gory detail as to how not to do what you seem to be doing reasonably well, a sort of cautionary tale, that paper on inverted apprenticeships, 90% of them were not all that healthy.
Yeah.
It's really hard to pull off.
Yeah, yeah, I get it. All right, in a moment, I'm going to ask you for a yes and story. But before we do that, very late in the book, this is in chapter 8, you say this is a throwaway line that is its own book.
Okay.
Which is, which is, quote, YouTube alone may well be the single biggest skills-enhancing innovation since the printing press, end quote.
Yes.
That is a provocative, huge statement, and I get it. And yeah. And it is like a DIY on steroids. That's what you're saying, right? This is...
Yeah, and it's kind of like... It is the worst that new option will ever be, is another thing to say.
And that's not that bad.
It's incredible. The number, I mean, who doesn't know somebody who goes to YouTube to figure out how-to questions? Like, how do I do this?
All the time.
I'm into crafting. I want to go on there and learn how to deal with a hot glue gun, but trying to deal with plastic. Somebody's got to figure that. And guess what they have? And they posted it. And by the way, they've narrated it now. And they produce little mm-hmm. materials to help you through it. And I think YouTube gets this. Just the new central repo for how-to knowledge. Procedural knowledge, there's different words for this. You could, I might say, use the word skill, actually. They're all the same. We're talking about not book learning or conceptual understanding, although that's baked into, because you got to get oriented. Like, what's going on here? But the other thing is, it's a new way for humans to connect with each other and transfer procedural knowledge, skill, because I can literally sit there and do some of that C1 and hear you talking through your process as you're dealing with your work. That is an incredible boon for somebody in Malaysia who wants to learn from somebody in you know, on the Jersey Shore. Totally possible now, right?
Yeah, I had to put together. I got a new speaker, little iRoar speaker, and it was different than my previous model. And literally, my wife is like, "Are you having trouble with that? Why don't you just YouTube it?" And I'm like, "Oh yeah, did it. Guy walked me through the whole thing." And just the other day, a colleague sent me, he's like, "Oh, I think you'd be interested in this." And it was basically a guy who accidentally ripped off Blue Note Records. They were looking to sue him. He pitched them an idea about doing more work to him. And that became this sort of legendary jazz album called Us Three, which sampled all the different Blue Note artists. And it was like really fun. And it was like, again, it was this YouTube take me through the story. And I'm like, this is done so precisely, so competently, short form. What a great way to learn. And certainly we know this because we do short form content learning programs here as well.
Sure.
But I think, again, to the point that people aren't talking about a lot of what you talk about in this book, that is not something I don't hear a lot of people talking about.
It's funny you should say that. Be careful what you say too. Right away when I turned in the manuscript for this book, the process of writing it was just a delight, and my editor was pretty effusive about how good I was at it, to be really candid. And I enjoyed the heck out of it. And they all are like, "Oh, obviously your next book, blah blah blah." And I'm like, "You all can go straight to hell." Like, you have no idea how hard this was.
Yeah.
And what possible idea? And I think you may, I'm not joking now, right here on this podcast, have given me that idea. Mm. I know, I'm doing more work in this direction that I'll be able to talk about soon. Involves actually trying to build not just YouTube, but what's the version of what we're talking about now that has AI infused into it in a way that is human connection enhancing?
Right.
That is my next project. And this question of how to stitch together, and that's the whole last chapter of the book, right? Is imagining a future with currently available technologies in which skill development and human connection are better than they could have been before we had all these technologies that are currently part of the problem. So I'm working on that kind of stuff. How could I not be optimistic? I think the chapter 5 will scare the heck out of people, and it should. The last chapter should give them hope and practical hope, not sort of, you know, vaporous, like imaginary. This is like, just take the tools we've got, twist them a little bit, put them together in a different way. We have a new infrastructure for skill development that respects, enriches this taken for granted infrastructure. And it'd be better than any human could have ever dreamed of before. I can see it right now. And so I think that book could be a good one. We'll see if I do it.
Yeah. I love it. I think about this too in the context of my wife is a tenured professor. She runs a comedy major, first ever comedy major.
Cool.
And what's interesting about these Because you know you're in this field. The young people coming into her, these very hip young people with generationally very different from other generations, and they're experiencing Marx Brothers, Ernie Kovacs, Chaplin, Carol Burnett, and they are producing content that is very much this contemporary POV, but also very influenced by people that is so long ago. That right. is so long ago,
yeah.
You know, and it's kind of beautiful to see. And so when we have this conversation, it's like, well, the only reason they get to do that is because they can listen to the record. They can see the film. They can see the episode. That's technology.
Right.
That is.
And what if there were a proactive, customized to you, generative AI agent that would go find stuff that you might be interested in, and or say, hey, I see you've been doing lots of this kind of how-to video watching. Do you want to meet blank, you know, this person over here? I can go talk with their agent and see if they'd be open to talking with you, but you could really use mentorship by somebody who's done rotoscoping or whatever.
Yeah.
And then all of a sudden you're talking with somebody in Jakarta. You would have never in a million years.
No.
No two humans could find each other that efficiently. So,
that's right.
I think that to bolt it on top of these raw resources, it's kind of like we're getting electricity and motors or something installed in our home. That's kind of useful. YouTube's great, but like we need a skill saw. We need a dishwasher, not just electricity and a motor. Like make it into a useful application. That's what's coming next, I think.
We always end the podcast asking our guest for a yes and story. Do you have one for us?
I think it just happened. Right?
I think it did too.
I think it just happened. So I am just incredibly grateful. It's funny how you, I think probably core to one of those yes and, or one of the things, this is from a naive point of view, one of the things that's consistent about those really profound yes and moments is that it involves seeing reality, seeing a pattern in reality that was there that you hadn't seen before, and that somebody jostles your head, you know, just tilts your vision, and you realize, oh, okay, I'd been systematically just choosing not to see that pattern, right? Or whatever. So in addition to the sort of mental flexibility or the sort of emotional ability to hear, receive, and respond, there's this sort of reality frame shift that happens. Anyway, not to get too abstract about it. The bottom line, you just told me the next book to write, and by God, I think I probably am going to go do it. So yes, and there's more to it, which is what the and is what I was offering you, right? It's not just write a book about YouTube, because that's like 2000 late.
Yeah, sort of. For sure. Yeah, for sure. The book is called Skill Code, How to Save Human Ability in an Age of Intelligent Machines. Matt Bean, thank you for coming on the pod.
It was an absolute delight.
Getting to Yes And is produced by Second City Works and WGN Radio. Our editor is Iridian Fierro from WGN. We get support at the Second City from Colleen Fahey, Mike Farinaccio, and Emma Smith. The music you hear at the beginning and end of the show is by Jukebox the Ghost. For more information about the Second City, you can go to www.secondcity.com, or you can email us directly at works@secondcity.com. Pounding into the ground each week. Every single
survive.